Since the advent of neorealism, two aspects have literally obsessed the vast majority of Italian film critics and experts. The aesthetic quality of the works, loosely understood as a mixture of festival marketability, high moral themes, international success, and overall enjoyability, and the potential for social change inherent in the single work of art. Such critical scheme withstood the strain of time until the realism slash modernism line did not exhaust itself in the 80s with the last cinematic gasps let out by Federico Fellini and Michelangelo Antonioni and a couple of successful blockbusters by Bernardo Bertolucci. It then became apparent that by merely looking at the meager number of Italian movies produced and distributed internationally, and at the absence of true auteur recognized internationally, the expression, quote, mourning the death of Italian cinema, unquote, was all but a true metaphor for a movement that in the past had expressed too much faith in authorial skills and high practices. It is a crisis that was exasperated in a way that is still very much felt today by the stagnation of critical literature, whereas besides important but mostly generalist works by Giampiero Brunetta, Lino Micciche, and Goffredo Fofi, the debate on the different lines and philosophical approaches of post-neorealist Italian film all but stood still, lamenting a season of harsh times as opposed to the glorious days of international success. The tendency was to celebrate the pomp of an idyllic past replaced by a melancholy vacuum retreating into a fossilized image of declined splendor. It's no accident that one of the most stimulating works recently published, Voce e Silenzio nel cinema di Pierpaolo Pasolini, written by Giacomo Manzoli, has a wider international breadth dealing with the dialogue between Pasolini and Christian Metz, and the contribution of the Italian filmmaker to film-applied semiotics. But leaving academic publications aside, on the newspapers and on TV, it was an endless trail of tears for a death that it was impossible not to acknowledge. The corpse of Italian film was grieved over from any possible angle. In general, journalists and reviewers were desperate to the point of saluting every lukewarm and backhanded compliment that Italian films received at international festivals as a true rebirth of Italian cinema, to which popular anchor Gianni Ippoliti replied, open quote, guys, the next time we have a rebirth of Italian cinema, please let us know beforehand, because we will arrive fully prepared for the glorious event, unquote. In order to get out of this quagmire, a new attention to everything low became the new mantra. A proper war ensued. Tired of listening to the old and immovable cliches, critics like Marco Giusti, Enrico Ghezzi, and Adriano Aprà, among others, sought to determine the role and function of low practices cinema in the general scheme of Italian film. At the same time, fanzines and magazines dedicated to Italy's kings of bees spontaneously erupted in the often soporific panorama of cinema publications, leading to a new wave of interest and enthusiasm for works that constituted the backbone of Italy's film industry from the late 60s until the early 80s. Even though the rediscovery of forgotten filmmakers as subgenres ultimately proved to be as nostalgic as the longing for a glamorous and respectable cinema, it served as the vehicle to bring to the surface all the works that were not officially part of Italy's cinematic body. The first names to be reinstated in the pantheon of Italian directors were Riccardo Freda, Mario Bava, Ruggero Deodato, and Antonio Margheriti and Lucio Fulci, among the others. By that point, even though Fernando Di Leo was certainly well known and widely appreciated by journalists like Gezi and Giusti, his name did not fully belong to the first wave or re-established filmmakers. But then, something unexpected happened. In 1994, Quentin Tarantino won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival with Pulp Fiction. And then in several interviews, released right after, stated, and reiterated ever since, that Di Leo was one of his, maybe his favorite director of all time, while another low-practice milestone like The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly was, in his opinion, the best movie ever made. If the canonization of Leone, Sergio Leone, had taken place well before this declaration, the majority of specialists, scholars, and simple cinephiles was taken by surprise. Who exactly was Fernando Di Leo? And why was he so important for Mr. Tarantino? Tarantino made clear that in the 80s, when the future director of Jackie Brown and Kill Bill was still a humble assistant in a Santa Monica video store, he stumbled on some films by the Italian director, who by then was one of the forgotten figures of Italian cinema. His thrillers of the early 70s had slipped into obscurity, and his career had ground to an untimely halt. As mentioned, Di Leo was no Sergio Leone, but he was no Mario Bava either, a director whose elegant and stylized horror movies had already been rediscovered and celebrated internationally. It was by sheer chance that Tarantino discovered Di Leo's work, but it inspired him to try to become a filmmaker himself. Among the many declarations released on Di Leo, there is one in particular that is worthy of being quoted in its entirety. Tarantino says, open quote, "During my adolescence, I worked as a shop assistant in a video store in Santa Monica, and one of the first cassettes I saw was significant for my future profession. It was I Padroni della Città. I didn't know the film was Italian, nor had I ever heard of Fernando Di Leo. I only remember that after watching the film, I was bowled over. Di Leo had produced a gangster film set in the streets of Rome, which could easily have been filmed by Don Siegel. There was the same energy in the directing, the same dry tone as in the great American thrillers. And Jack Palance was simply fantastic in the part of the disfigured man. After seeing I Padroni della Città, I became obsessed, and I began systematically to track down and watch the other films Di Leo had directed. The first I saw was La Mala Ordina, which in my opinion is a true masterpiece of police thriller. I can still remember the impact this little Italian had on me as he was swallowed up in the big league and given orders from New York to take on the pair of killers played by Henry Silva and Woody Strode. I think that in this film, Di Leo gave his all. There's also an amazing chase between the glutton and the guy who's killed his wife and daughter, which lasts at least a quarter of an hour. At a certain point, he leaps onto a truck and smashes the windscreen with his head. Yes, he butts it with his head. Amazing. Only a great director could imagine and film such a long scene without losing the tension for an instant. Then I got hold of Il Boss, which in America was distributed with the name Wipeout. This is another masterpiece full of bitterness and cruelty, again featuring the legendary Henry Silva playing a mafia killer who murders everyone to get to the top and reach our content. The thing I like about Di Leo's characters is that they're real delinquent SOBs, but never standardized or fake figures. And there's always an underlying irony, even in the grimmest things shown, and this makes his film truly unique. I owe Fernando a great deal in terms of passion and filmmaking." Close quote. Di Leo's films are quintessential B-movies. Garish, intricately plotted, ultra-violent stories about pimps and petty gangsters, told with plenty of attitude. There is an intensity and formal ingenuity here that you rarely find in more prestigious and expensive pictures. For example, we can look at the beginning of Milano Calibro 9, in which we see a bag containing $300,000 belonging to the local Mr. Big, the Americano, whisked across Milan. Somehow, as couriers dart in and out of subways and across busy streets, the bag is switched and the money stolen. This bravura sequence is shot almost entirely without dialogue. After Tarantino made Di Leo enter the world of serious film and elected him in a peculiar hall of fame, that is the hall of fame where Italian filmmakers inspiring great international directors are found, the momentum was unstoppable. As mentioned earlier, a retrospective also sponsored by Joe Dante and Jonathan Demme was organized at the Venice Film Festival, where Tarantino himself presented a special homage to Di Leo. Milano Calibro 9 is the first installment in a three-film series called the Milieu Trilogy. A few words about the plots will get us deeper inside Di Leo's world of crime. In Milano Calibro 9, small-time gangster Ugo Piazza has just been released from prison and is trying to go straight. However, he soon finds himself accused of having stolen money and unable to escape the grip of his one-time associate Rocco, a sadistic hoodlum. Milano Calibro 9 stylized violence faced by action sequences, tight editing and plot twists not only prefigure the work of Tarantino but also of John Woo. The second film in Fernando Di Leo's Milieu trilogy, La Mala Ordina, focuses on Luca Canali, a small-time mobster and pimp who has been set up by his gangland boss. Canali is pursued through Milan by a pair of merciless American hitmen, played by Henry Silva and Woody Strode, and referenced by Quentin Tarantino in Pulp Fiction, who mistakenly believe that he has stolen a drug shipment. Following the murder of his wife, the hunted becomes the hunter, as Canali takes his revenge on his boss, the hitman, and anyone else who stands in his way. Based largely on real people and actual events, Fernando Di Leo's action-packed film Il Boss, the final part of this Milieu trilogy, is his boldest commentary on corruption and the criminal underworld. Henry Silva plays Lanzetta, a hired killer employed by mafia boss Don Giuseppe Daniello to assassinate the rival family. Following a successful hit, he finds himself in the midst of the ensuing gangland war, with Daniello attempting to turn him into the police, his boss's daughter's kidnapped, and the rival gang looking for revenge. It was this low-life world that finally, after receiving critical praise from Tarantino, made it to the ceremonious officiality of the Venice Film Festival. Open quote. I was accused by a lot of Italian critics of having lost any sense of the institutions by opening the gates of the festival to trash cinema, close quote, said Venice Festival director Marco Müller, commenting on the 2004 Kings of Bees retrospective. Until recently, Müller pointed out, the work of filmmakers such as Di Leo was regarded with disdain in Italy. Their films were far more readily available in the UK and the US than in Italy. But Müller also argued that Di Leo's gangster films offer a far more accurate picture of Italy than documentaries or big budget feature films of the period. Open quote. If you really want to understand the Italy of the 70s, Müller said, with political extremism on both left and right as a response to the corruption and the mafia infiltration in all the centers of political and financial power, look to Di Leo. Di Leo's films may have been conceived as exploitation pictures, but they deal with social and political issues. Open quote. I wanted to demonstrate the reality of the degrading of the working class on the outskirts of a major city where organized criminality was starting to spread its first tentacles and where the youth had not yet entered this vicious circle, close quote. The director commented on his early feature, I ragazzi del massacro. Since then, many books have come out highlighting the crucial role of B-movies in Italy's cinematic history, and the theoretical focus has become increasingly sharper, even involving unexpected figures. For example, influence scholar Goffredo Fofi swiftly jumped on the DiLeo bandwagon by writing a celebratory piece on the occasion of the Venice screening, even though he never wrote a line about him when DiLeo was actually alive and working at full throttle. Other prominent critics, like Tullio Kesich, following the hurried definition of Lino Michiche, who had previously labeled Italy's B-movies as cinema di profondità for their deep exploration of the genres and their wide social appeal, but also as cinema di gastronomia for their ready-made and disposable nature, dismissed the whole Venice operation as useless trash. To despiteful remarks, Marco Giusti replied, making two very important points and actually reinforcing the validity of the recognition operation he embarked on. Firstly, such critical disputes at least witness the presence of something you can argue about, whereas today, in Italian cinema, we are condemned to a sort of pneumatic vacuum. Secondly, Giusti pointed out how easy it was to make a movie at the time because of the extreme professionalism of the production system, loaded with excellent craftsmen and technicians, thus making us understand how the industrial aspect of cinema has been neglected in the populist approach, seeing movies as vehicles of beauty and social change. After all this gigantic work of rediscovery, reassessment, and restoration, it is today safe to say that the development of Italian cinema from the 60s onwards was made possible in part because underlying its progress existed an underground of directors and craftsmen who embraced low practices in their efforts to reinvent the first true Italian genre cinema. As previously said, the film program that surveyed the thrilling, hard-hitting works of Fernando Di Leo, Sergio Martino, Lucio Fulci, Massimo Dallamano, and Mario Bava, among others, was first shown in Venice at the 2004 Film Festival, with subsequent installments focusing on specific genres like the spaghetti western. The first series was also then taken to Tate Modern Gallery in London. On that occasion, Tate Modern organized also a collection display entitled Beyond Painting, Burri, Fontana, Manzoni, which presented groundbreaking Italian painting from the same period and similarly marked by its ambiguous relationship to creativity and destruction. A final word on DiLeo cinematic approach. Among the influences on DiLeo, the most significant name we can mention is Jean-Pierre Melville, and specifically his movies Les Doulots of 1962 and Les Samouraïs of 1967, with the use of losers and anti-heroes, but also, on a more systematic level, the polar genre with its representation of violence and passions under different forms, in particular the most despicable and contemptible ones, like carnages and gory beatings for the first, as well as pitiless hate and desperate love for the second. Furthermore, ascribing the milieu trilogy to the film noir line, we can also match its first sequences with one of the first scene of Kiss Me Deadly by Robert Aldrich of 1955, when Cloris Leachman is tortured to death by thugs, and more important, borrowing other essential components like morally ambiguous protagonists and existential underpinnings. I want to finish this paper mentioning a problem that, in my opinion, deserves further discussion. We saw how this rediscovery effort has initiated a sort of appropriation sui generis of Italy's B-movies by American filmmakers. That has in turn sparked an even more genuine attention for innovative languages, styles, and social problems those pictures dealt with. And yet, on the other hand, has let Tarantino dictate the direction of the philological research, to some extent doing what Douglas Sirk did in the 60s when he informed the film world that his works were in fact manifestos of subversion. On the one hand, we have to recall Mr. Mueller's words about the problems that nowadays genre movies still create to the public, words attesting to the delay of such movies' appropriate critical placement and reinforcing the often useless separation of high and low practices. Thus, cinema enthusiasts must be thankful to Mr. Tarantino for his unconditional love for Di Leo, Leone, Dario Argento, and Mario Bava, among others. But on the other hand, we should not forget that a once prominent filmmaker, Mr. Tarantino, has elected the pulp to be his realm and not the fiction, simply recycling with what is, in my opinion, very weak motivation themes, characters when not entire sequences of old genre movies. It is my personal belief that Tarantino has squandered the capital amassed with his early works by becoming an assembly machine that seamlessly digests and reprocesses music, styles, and plots from B cinema in order to sew together his Frankensteinian pictures. The director, who could have rivaled with seminal filmmakers like the Henry Jamesian French director François Ozon, or the flamboyant Japanese director Takashi Miike, thanks to his masterly manipulation of fiction, has instead elected another aspect of postmodernism as his personal blueprint: the serial reproduction and endless quotation and intertextuality, subtracting meaning from the original. It is what we can observe in Kill Bill and Death Proof, a series of superimposed characterization that could easily be switched or replaced by other ones with no real consequence on the final product, the ultimate triumph of postmodernism as it is transformed into a purely commercial device by a filmmaker treating his sources as one-dimensional products. Yes, in doing so, he shows great love and devotion for Italian cinema, and that makes us proud. But the impression is that Di Leo, Leone, and others are part of a poetics that has steadily regressed from the time of Pulp Fiction. Thank you.
So thank you very much, Antonio. And Mr. Bartoni is willing to take a few questions, if you have. Please.
I'm just wondering how this fits into the whole corpus of Italian art. I mean, I know Dante and Petrarch, when they wrote, they considered what they were writing, they didn't think that what they were writing in the vulgar, the Italian, they thought that that was not going to survive, while the works that they wrote in Latin would end up being what they were remembered for. Now, how do you think that the movies by Di Leo and such fit into the whole corpus of Italian art throughout the ages?
Well, I think, as I said, it depends what our perspective is. I mean, what are we really looking for? Not just as viewers, as lovers, as insiders, as also legislators. What are we really looking for in film? Are we more interested in like the aesthetic pleasure? What are we going to give up? What's the compromise? What's the where's the balance? The fact, what struck me was the fact that in the generalist works about the most celebrated Italian scholars, Brunetta, Michiquet, and others, this body of works, we talk about maybe thousands of works, but several hundreds, is like a footnote in the history of Italian cinema. And then again, the question is why? In my opinion, because this stance, this like, I would call it a political stance of cinema as like a medium where the director must explore the potential for social change / improvement as well as a vehicle of beauty was established very early by Western Canada, maybe right after the war with liberalism. I mean, this stands as pros but also cons. And for example, where is the industrial aspect of it? Is it more important or less important? Because also it's very important also for neorealism. So some issues were completely left out of the discussion. And so the answer is about the durability, about the like long-term durability.
Well, what I'm saying is that what Dante and Petrarch considered what they were doing, it's very similar to how De Leo is considered, because Dante and Petrarch thought that their writing in the dialect in Italian was vulgar, and it was not as clean, it was not as moral as writing in Latin. And I feel that there's a similarity between De Leo, how De Leo seems to be, it's the low art. It's not representing the high aspect of it.
I think we can like frame early vulgar works with this like popular works in the same frame. The same frame is like the development of realism in Italy. The book My Mises by Eric Auerbach mentions that even in the Divine Comedy, we should like switch our perspective and think about it as a, like the about like the afterlife as a way to describe real events in Italy. So I think we can kind of find a number of mediations where we can find the same attitude here. So again, a number of apt metaphors describing the real Italy, what's going on, what's really the situation. So I think maybe framing the vulgar work, the works written in vulgar and popular cinema as vehicle of getting to a more real image.
Right, yes. Thank you.
Other questions?
Yeah, I have a question. So you're saying that, if I'm understanding correctly, that work like Tarantino's work, let me just say that you feel like that Leone is not maybe as important as other people because they're not sort of interjecting. It seems like we're judging it. First of all, I think judging art is really sort of not getting what art is, in my opinion. But beyond that, I mean, because I think the sort of the function of a critic, no matter what their discipline is to sort of inform others of what, you know, that art is and their opinion. But and so you sort of find someone that you sort of agree with and therefore it's like a gauge of maybe what you want to spend your time either seeing or doing or whatever. But let me say that I think that sort of saying that those things are not valid or that they don't have as much beauty or art as the movies that they copied or anything else is really, I think, pretty naive. And that if you don't think that these movies affected people as deeply or in as an important way, I don't see how that's really. First of all, I don't know how anyone judges that, but I don't know how you.
No, my personal position is that these movies are as important as, if not more.
Right.
Maybe I was not clear in my presentation, but that's
as
my
important, yeah.
As important, yeah. At least even more. I mean, I agree with those who embarked on this recognition operation, because it was like it was a matter of like going deeper and deeper into the high masters of Italian film, and actually probably.
Well, I guess my question is, what does that? How do you become a high master? Like, what does that mean exactly?
Well,
like, who judges what that is?
Right.
Is it in mass? The masses? Do they decide that, or is it?
Well,
do you think it's a quantity? Like, you.
I think what happened was, as I said, it was like a cluster of different aspects, like a very very strong emphasis, how loose it can be on content. So the movie must have a content. Doesn't have content if it's exploitation, cannibal, vulgar comedy, spaghetti western. Doesn't have a content.
Explain that. What do you mean by that?
I mean that the critical short circuit of like the you can. Find it in most of the literature on Italian film is what the director makes in terms of representing what does the director do for the people who are not there, who are these people. There is a strong emphasis on exploring the medium for its potential for social change. That's content.
So that
this has historical cultural reasons, political reasons, if you want.
So I'm saying do I hear you correctly? You're saying that you're putting responsibility on the art itself. You're making it responsible.
To some extent, I think it's fair to say that. Many works in Italy were made already with like a pre-sense of censorship, almost like in order to prevent the potential critics from attacking the movie. Then directors would try to, knee, so to speak, not kneel down in front of the critics and try to cajole the critics with the themes that they would have liked.
What do you think that's right?
Yes.
You do?
I think that it's fair to say that for some works, it's right, yes.
Okay, so you think that some works should be censored or therefore...
No.
But... That's not what you're saying?
No, sorry, maybe... I have a bad comment of English language.
Sorry, our time is over. You can chat with Baratoni afterwards, but we have to leave. And please feel free to enjoy our food, and thanks again for coming. Thank you.